This is Glass City Humanist, a show about humanism, humanist values, by a humanist. Here is your host, Douglas Berger.
In this episode, we look at how a secular person can be included when there are so many religiously based holidays being celebrated at this time. Then we take a deep dive into the real origins of the religious right.
Glass City Humanist is an outreach project of the Secular Humanists of Western Lake Erie, building community through compassion and reason for a better tomorrow.
As this is being recorded, it is the month of December, and every year, the month of December, there are many, many holidays. I took a look to see how many holidays are celebrated in December. And obviously, there's quite a few religious holidays. We have Christmas, obviously. There's Advent, Hanukkah, Feast of the Holy Family, the Death of Prophet Zarathustra. Then you have Kwanzaa, you know, and those are just, you know, like I said, those are just religious holidays. Now, some people, you know, question, you know, when we're talking about humanism, you know, I guess they come out and they say, well, I guess you aren't allowed to celebrate these holidays, right? Because you're humanist, you're non-religious, you're secular. Most of us are secular. And that's not necessarily true. One of the main things about holidays that we latch onto, even though we don't go for the religious meaning, is, you know, it's a time to gather with friends and family and honor and celebrate the end of the year, because we have, you know, New Year's Eve coming up at the end of the month. And, you know, and it's winter time and it's time to gather and cook some food and have a communal meal, pass out gifts. You know, there's a lot of things that you can do that aren't necessarily specifically religious and still celebrate a holiday. And there's also some, oddly enough, some secular type holidays in December as well. One that's been around for a little while is called Human Light. The date for Human Light is December the 23rd, which is probably one of the reasons why I don't personally celebrate it. I try to avoid secular things that co-opt religious things, that obviously co-opt religious things. And having it on the 23rd just, I don't know, just seems too much. But we also have the winter solstice, which is, you know, the 21st, 22nd, you know, of December. There's also a one that's based in TV history called Festivus. That was a holiday created by the character George Costanza on Seinfeld by his father to as a counterpoint to the crash commercialism of Christmas, which still exists. You know, there's still a lot of commercialism about Christmas. And so the character's dad had come up with Festivus, and you had a Festivus poll and giving of grievances and tests of strength. And it caught on. I mean, it's still popular for many people who followed the TV show. But that's one way. The other thing to consider, too, is a lot of the trappings of the Christmas holiday is not originally religious. Having a Christmas tree in your house, that's a pagan ritual. The pagans used to do that. They used to bring evergreens into their house in order to bless the thing, you know, the winter and making sure that they have a good harvest the next spring. So they would bring evergreens, which never die during the wintertime, into the house and decorate it with candles and things like that. And in fact, most people kind of ignore or don't acknowledge that one of the strictest religious orders, the guys that they're the people that we celebrate for founding, coming to the New World, the Puritans, who had come to the New World that eventually became the United States in order to practice their religion freely, they outlawed Christmas. Because back in those times, back in the 16, 1700s, Christmas was a party. Drunkenness, public drunkenness, and it was an all-night party and debauchery and stuff like that. So when the Puritans got their own area in Massachusetts, one of the first things they did was they outlawed the celebration of Christmas. You know, a lot of the religious conservatives, when they're going on about the war on Christmas, they forget that their brethren in the early days had outlawed it. And there's still some religious groups that don't celebrate Christmas. I believe Jehovah's Witnesses, they don't celebrate Christmas. There's also some extreme religious conservatives that don't celebrate Christmas. They don't believe in giving gifts to people. They only believe in giving gifts to Jesus. This one article I read, what they would do is they would have a birthday cake for Jesus. And it would be all about Jesus, because obviously in the story, that's why it's called Christmas, is because it's the birth of Jesus. Even though the dates, you know, the historical record is murky, and anyway, we're not going to get into that today. The other thing that we have, the other conflict that we have sometimes with religious conservatives is saying happy holidays to be inclusive. A lot of retail clerks and people going about their business during the holiday season, you know, you'll see somebody, you'll say happy holidays. And well, religious conservatives just get all up in arms about it. And like I said, they call it the war on Christmas because you're trying to outlaw Christmas. And that's not the case. Basically, if you say happy holidays to somebody, you're trying to be as inclusive as you can. You know, because you don't know that person. See, that's the thing, is you come up to a person and I think it's wrong to assume that one, that they're Christian, and two, that they celebrate Christmas. You know, they might not. They might not be Christian. They might not be, they might not celebrate Christmas. So saying happy holidays is you're being nice and considerate to somebody. And it's being inclusive. You know, maybe it's somebody who celebrates Kwanzaa. You know, maybe it's somebody that is Orthodox and they're following the Advent, or the Orthodox Russian Orthodox Church, they don't even celebrate Christmas. They celebrate Christmas in January. The birth of Christ is celebrated on, I believe, January the 7th. You know, and so if you say Merry Christmas to them, they're not going to know what you're talking about. But if you say Happy Holidays, that's just a way of building relationships with people, and that's important. You know, a lot of times when we have strife and violence about surrounding religion, it's because people don't want to know each other. They don't want to build relationships and know that we're all in the same boat and that we need to work together and do these things. And so it's important to say that to people, say happy holidays. The other thing that I wanted to talk about with, in particular, humanism and the holidays and ways for non-religious people to celebrate. And I kind of wanted to, this is something that comes up every year, is one of the things that my humanist group, the Secular Humanists of Western Lake Erie, one of the things that we've done the past few years is we've sponsored a family through the Lucas County Children's Services. And what that means is that we tell them that we'll sponsor a family, and they assign us somebody with their wants and needs, and we fill it, and we get them gifts. Because a lot of the families that go through the Lucas County Children's Services, they're struggling, they need help, and it's something nice to do. And one of the things that I get from members that talk to me about this is you know, they're like, you know, these people need help all year round, and they do. There's a lot of people that are struggling that need assistance all year round, and they have a point. It just seems disingenuous at times to focus so much on holiday time, December, to do charity work and to help people. It seems a little bit condescending to the people that are struggling that need assistance. Well, you know, throughout the rest of the year, we're not going to do anything for you, but hey, here in December, we're going to clean out our closet and here's some old clothes we don't wear. My group, one year we volunteered at one of the local food banks, and we were clearing out all this crappy food. It was like stuff that you wouldn't even buy. People normally wouldn't consume normally. And they had shelves just chock full of stuff that was close to expiration date, you know, canned goods. You can't keep canned goods forever. And it looked like people were cleaning out their cupboards and getting rid of canned goods that they had had for years, you know, and it was just bothersome. And so one of the things that we decided to do was when we set up our campaign for this year in particular, is let people know that we acknowledge that these people need assistance all year round, and we're going to try to do something all year round. We have tentatively planned that we're going to volunteer at a food bank probably in February coincide with Darwin Day, Charles Darwin Day. And that's one of the things we want to do is go in February. And then we'll try to do it again in the next quarter, like during the summer, and try to find opportunities where we can help people all year round. Because people need help all year round. The other thing too is when we're helping food banks, one of the things that we want to do is we also want to donate cash, actual money, to the food banks, not just our old canned goods, our old food that we want to get rid of, our old clothes, you know, things like that. You know, when you donate to other charities that like Goodwill and Salvation Army. I don't know why people would donate to Salvation Army, but anyway, that's a whole other story we're not going to get into. But, you know, that's one of the things that we want to do going forward, and that's kind of like a common sense thing that we've come up with, is that we are going to identify places and things where we can help people all through the year. You know, we might try to sponsor a family locally, you know, outside of an agency. Maybe we hear about somebody that needs help. Maybe they have, I don't know, common thing, a house fire. Maybe they got burned out from a house fire and they need assistance. We might try to assist them with that way. We're still a small group, so there's not a lot we can do, but we're going to try. And one of the things that we talked about was about how religious groups like Catholic Charities and some of these other big charitable groups are able to do a lot because they have a large infrastructure, and that makes it hard for a small group like ours. But we're going to try to do what we can to help people and try to do that all year round. So when it's coming up to the holidays and you're looking, you know, like I said, there's many different holidays that you can celebrate during December. It doesn't matter. You can even make up your own if you want. And the main thing is, you know, just coming together with people that maybe you don't see all the time, sharing a communal meal, maybe exchanging gifts, it doesn't matter. And so you can still fit in during this holiday time with religious people who are celebrating it for different reasons. But, you know, you don't have to be excluded. And it also would also do well for you to say to people, happy holidays, to try to be as inclusive as possible.
For more information about the topics in this episode, including links used, please visit the episode page at glasscityhumanist.show.
One of our recent monthly programs, in fact, the one we just had in December for the Secular Humanists of Western Lake Erie, we talked about the real origins of the religious right. And we showed a video of a talk given by historian Randall Balmer. He's a professor of church history and religion studies at Dartmouth, and he wrote a book. It was called Bad Faith, Race and the Rise of the Religious Right. And so the talk that we showed in our interview, and I'll play a clip in a little bit, was given last year in 2022 after the Dobbs decision. And he talks about one of the myths about the rise of the religious right in claiming that it was all about abortion, stopping abortions. And he said that was not true. And he's done historical research. He's talked to the people, the powers that be in the religious right movement, the evangelical. And we're talking about evangelical Christianity, which makes up a large part of the religious right. We're talking about people like Jerry Falwell, who was the founder of Liberty University and his church in Virginia, and Paul Reinrich, and, you know, there's quite a lot of Ralph Reed, you know. And basically what it is we're talking about evangelical Christians who use their religion to justify their conservative agenda, political agenda. So they're using their religion to justify their politics. And as Professor Balmer points out, that's a bad mix. And that's one of the reasons why we have the First Amendment, because one of the things it's trying to prevent is people using their religion to hurt other people, you know, either taking away their rights or making the Bible part of law, you know, making law out of the Bible, things like that. And so, you know, Professor Balmer did a lot of research in writing his book, and he discovered that it's a myth that the rise of the religious right in the 70s and 80s was a result of a battle against abortion. And in fact, he points out that Jerry Falwell didn't have a sermon against abortion until 1979. And some other religious right group, evangelical groups like the Southern Baptist Convention and some others actually came out with statements in the late 60s, early 70s, particularly around the time that Roe v. Wade was decided, that called for the legalization of abortion. And he also points out that a lot of Protestant evangelicals didn't latch on to abortion because they considered it a Catholic thing, because Catholics have always been opposed to abortion. And so he had a lot of interesting things to talk about in this talk. And like I said, I'm going to play a clip here in a little bit, and I'm going to share the link in the show notes so you can go watch it, because it's very interesting, you know, a lot of the things that he talks about. Now, I'm going to date myself. I grew up in the 70s and early 80s when I was in school. And I had always understood that the rise in the religious right came about because of a conflict with teaching sex education in public schools. That was a big thing when I was in junior high school in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, was teaching sex education. And it got a lot of feedback from conservative parents who didn't want their little Timmy and Joni to be taught sex education. And in fact, the point that I made out at the meeting was, you know, I had two friends of mine, two good friends, they were brothers, Tracy and Terry, And they came from a very strict conservative religious household. So much so that they weren't allowed to watch much TV. They weren't allowed to watch much TV. They weren't allowed to go to R-rated movies, that sort of thing. They weren't allowed to go dancing. Oh boy, that sounds like a that sounds like the plot line to Footloose. Anyway, and so one of the conflicts that they had with doing it in my school district is parents demanded to be able to opt out their kids if they didn't want them to learn. And Tracy and Terry were the only two people in my class that opted out of sex education. And they had to, when we were going to start that chapter in our health class, they actually had to get up, take their books, and leave the room. And then they went to another room and did homework. And so, you know, you have a kid, you know, 10, 11, 12-year-old kid, basically you're being ostracized because, you know, that's the one thing. You don't want to draw attention to yourself when you're that young. And they were being, they had their, you know, stuff, they had their attention drawn to them, which they did not wish for it to be. Anyway, so that's what I always thought. I always thought it was sex education, and other people think it was abortion. And Professor Ballmer points out that it was none of that. It wasn't abortion at all. And in fact, you know, I'm going to spoil it. So if you don't want to hear it, turn down the volume now. The real origins of the religious right is racial discrimination, believe it or not. Well, for those of us who've studied this area for a long time, it's not a surprise, but it might be a surprise to people that don't, you know, that don't get into the politics of church and state. But basically what happened was that there was a court decision in 1971 that disallowed tax exemptions for religiously based or religiously church-sponsored schools that were segregated, that discriminated against children of color that didn't admit them. And many of these schools were founded by churches. And normally, things that are founded by churches and operated by churches get a tax exemption from the federal government. And so somebody sued, or this group of parents sued because they didn't want this school to get tax exemption. And so the court ruled that if the school was founded and one of their policies was to discriminate, they could not have a tax exemption, which is generally true in general, that racial discrimination, you can't get a tax exemption for racial discrimination. That's one of the protected classes in the Civil Rights Act. And so a lot of these conservatives who were segregationists didn't want the government to tell them that they had to admit black students. And so they started getting politically active. And most of the people that were, politically active at this point were the power brokers, the people in charge, like the Jerry Falwells and the Ralph Reeds of the time, Paul Reinrich and Francis Schaeffer and some other big wigs. They were politically active for that. You know, they wanted to be able to discriminate based on race. They wanted to keep out, because when you had the Brown v. Board of Education that forced the integration of public schools, a lot of these white families took their kids out of school, public school, and founded these private academies, religious academies, and kept out the black students. So this was the whole thing. So that was what set up the rise of the religious right, was they wanted to be able to discriminate. And one of the big named schools that lost tax exemption was Bob Jones University. I believe it's in South Carolina. They lost their tax exemption and they've never asked for it back. And they use that in their advertising that they don't take any money from the federal government. And the thing is, you know, most people are like, well, it's a tax exemption. What's up? Well, it's basically a subsidy. It's a government subsidy because these religious groups and churches are not paying taxes. They're not paying income tax. They're not paying property tax. And so other people then that live near them or are in the same city as them have to pay a little bit more for them to still get the same services. So they still get covered by the police and fire and sewage and all that stuff. So other people are paying for that. So that's why it's a subsidy. And that's why it's important that these religious groups and churches follow the rules. You know, if you want to have a tax exemption, if you don't want to pay this tax, then you need to not discriminate.
With the retrospective of 81% of white evangelicals supporting Donald Trump for president in 2016, and again, a similar percentage in 2020, I think even actually a higher percentage in 2020. And trying to reconcile that with the origins of the religious right. Here you have a movement that had its origins in racism. And then you have this improbable, I mean, on the face of it, let's be honest about this. On the face of it, Donald Trump is not the traditional family values candidate. And this is a movement that for decades has been touting itself as a family values movement. And so I was trying to reconcile that and try to understand how we got to point from point A to point B. And it occurred to me in the course of writing this book that the real transitional figure here is Reagan himself. And as I looked a little bit more closely into Ronald Reagan's history and his career, it became clear to me that there's more than a coincidental juxtaposition of issues and concerns here. Reagan got into politics in California in opposition to the Rumford Fair Housing Act, which sought to guarantee equal access to both rental housing as well as the purchase of housing. He was an outspoken opponent of both the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act in 1965. As president, he decimated the Civil Rights Commission. He maintained his support for the apartheid regime in South Africa long into the 1980s. And throughout his political campaigns, he frequently invoked the racially charged phrase, law and order. And anyone who lived through that era can never forget his vile caricature of so-called welfare queens, women of color who were supposedly living the high life off of the public dole. He was never able to produce any of these welfare queens, but he talked as though they actually existed. And for me, I guess the most damning thing was his opening of his general election campaign in 1980, August 3rd, 1980, at the Neshoba County Fair in Philadelphia, Mississippi, the place where 16 summers earlier, three civil rights workers, two Jews and an African American, were abducted, tortured, and murdered by the Ku Klux Klan in collusion with the local sheriff's department. And Reagan, of course, was the master of symbolism. And lest anyone miss his meaning, he declared the age-old segregationist battle cry, "I believe in states' rights." Now, Reagan could have opened his general election campaign in any number of places. California, his adopted home state, would certainly have been a good place because California was very much in play in the 1980 presidential election. He could have gone to one of the Rust Belt cities that had been decimated by the economic distress of the 1970s. Instead, he chose, of all places, Philadelphia, Mississippi, at the Neshoba County Fair. That, to me, is a pretty good indication of Reagan's sentiments on these particular matters. And so as I began to think about that, what is the connection between the origins of the religious right and the overwhelming white support for Donald Trump in 2016 and 2020, I have to believe that one of the links in that loop has to be Ronald Reagan in his throughout his political career, particularly in the 1980s. Now, all of this narrative, does this mean that all evangelicals are racists? I don't believe that's the case at all. Again, I grew up within this movement. I think there are a lot of blind spots that many evangelicals have about racial matters, but I don't believe that evangelicals overwhelmingly are racist. Nevertheless, I think they need to come to terms with the origins of their political movement.
I just want to make it clear again that, you know, I'm talking about the power brokers, the people that are in charge, the leaders of the evangelical movement, such as Paul Reinrich and Ralph Reed and Francis Schaeffer. You know, some of these people are not with us anymore. Jerry Falwell was one. I'm talking about those people that use religion to advance their conservative political agenda, either to take people's rights away, such as banning abortion, or sponsoring a bill to prohibit trans people from using the bathroom of the gender that they identify with, or things like that. So, you know, that's who I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the average everyday evangelical who goes to church and donates to charity and does those other things. And I'm not saying that as Professor Ballmer points out, he's not saying that they're all racist. But I agree with him in the point that he made that the foundation of a lot of these groups is rotten to the core. And if the foundation is rotten, eventually it's going to collapse on itself. And so if you have, John and Jane Q. Public, who's going to an evangelical Methodist church, and they discriminate against LGBT people, because some of them do. They just had this big schism. These churches left the Methodist group, and they donate money to the church who discriminate against LGBT people. You're in effect supporting that discrimination. So even if you yourself don't hate LGBT people, the fact that you're giving money to this organization that does is you're indirectly supporting that discrimination. And so all I ask is, if you are a religious conservative and you aren't racist and you don't, you try to love all your neighbors as the Bible says, that maybe you need not to support those organizations that do. For example, and businesses too, like Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A supports anti-abortion groups in their charitable giving. But, there's always this huge lineup for their chicken sandwiches. So you're indirectly giving money to religious groups that will hurt the people that you don't hate. And so it's just it's one of the things that we deal with every day, is how you balance that, how you balance your values. You don't want to discriminate. If that's not part of who you are, it makes it tough, especially for when you're talking about religious, especially religious people and their churches. Maybe they're going to the same church that their parents went, and their parents went to, and their parents went to, and their parents went to, and there's a long history in this family. And yet it's a religious conservative church that doesn't support helping poor people, or they give money to political campaigns, which they're not supposed to do. Or like we had this church over by where I live that had a candidate forum for Josh Mandel during when he was running for U.S. Senate, and he was the only one there because they were supporting this guy, and I reported it. I reported it to the IRS because people that get the tax exemption, the 501(c), like my group, we are not allowed to support individual candidates. We're not allowed to support or tell people not to support individual candidates because that's a violation of our rules. So kind of bringing this back to the tax exemption, the Bob Jones case, today in 2023, the IRS does not enforce that rule about the tax exemption in religious groups. There's a backlog, in fact, of cases that they haven't even investigated because these conservatives who get in office that people, you know, from the gerrymandered maps and other privileges that these religious conservative, well, I wouldn't consider them all religious conservatives, but these conservatives, they get into political office and then they change the rules. And that's what they've done is they've kind of intimidated the IRS from investigating conservative religious groups that are obviously violating the tax laws. And so that's the trouble, you know. And so that's why I'm appealing to people who might be listening to this to, you know, think about where you donate your money, where you spend your money, so that you're not indirectly supporting discrimination or not indirectly supporting a conservative agenda that hurts people that you love. And that's all I'm asking you to do.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the topics in this episode, please visit the episode page at glasscityhumanist.show. Glass City Humanist is an outreach of the Secular Humanists of Western Lake Erie. Sholi can be reached at humanistswle.org. Glass City Humanist is hosted, written, and produced by Douglas Berger, and he's solely responsible for the content. Our theme music is Glass City Jam, composed using the Amplify Studio. See you next time.